Chapter 22. After she returned from the Vizniak's apartment, Isabel lit an oil lamp and went into the salon, where she found her father asleep at the dining room table, his head resting on the hard wood as if he'd passed out. Beside him was a half-empty brandy bottle that had been full not long ago. She took the bottle and put it on the sideboard, hoping that out of reach would equal out of mind in the morning. She almost reached out for him, almost stroked the gray hair that obscured his face, a small, oval-shaped bald spot revealed by repose. She wanted to be able to touch him that way, in comfort, in love, in companionship. Instead, she went into the kitchen, where she made a pot of bitter, dark, made from acorns coffee, and found a small loaf of the tasteless gray bread that was all the Parisians could get anymore. She broke off a piece. What would Madame Dufour say about that, eating while walking? And chewed it slowly.
"That coffee smells like shit," her father said, bleary-eyed, lifting his head as she came into the room.
She handed him her cup.
"It tastes worse."
Isabel poured another cup of coffee for herself and sat down beside him. The lamplight accentuated the roadmap look of his face, deepening the pits and wrinkles, making the flesh beneath his eyes look wax-like and swollen. She waited for him to say something, but he just stared at her. Beneath his pointed gaze, she finished her coffee. She needed it to swallow the dry, terrible bread, and pushed the empty cup away. Isabel stayed there until he fell asleep again, and then she went into her own room. But there was no way she could sleep. She lay there for hours, wondering and worrying. Finally, she couldn't stand it anymore. She got out of bed and went into the salon.
"I'm going out to see," she announced.
"Don't," he said,
still seated at the table.
"I won't do anything stupid."
She returned to her bedroom and changed into a summer-weight blue skirt and short-sleeved white blouse. She put a faded blue silk scarf around her messy hair, tied it beneath her chin, and left the apartment. On the third floor, she saw that the door to the Vizniak apartment was open. She peered inside. The room had been looted. Only the biggest pieces of furniture remained, and the drawers of the black Bombay chest were open. Clothes and inexpensive knick-knacks were scattered across the floor. Rectangular black marks on the wall revealed missing artwork. She closed the door behind her. In the lobby, she paused just long enough to compose herself, and then opened the door. Buses rolled down the street, one after another. Through the dirty bus windows, she saw dozens of children's faces, with their noses pressed to the glass, and their mother seated beside them. The sidewalks were curiously empty. Isabel saw a French policeman standing at the corner, and she went to him.
"Where are they going?"
"Vélodrome d'hiver."
"The sporting stadium? Why?"
"You don't belong here. Go, or I'll put you on a bus and you'll end up with them."
"Maybe I'll do that. Maybe..."
The policeman leaned close, whispered,
"Go!"
He grabbed her arm and dragged her to the side of the road.
"Our orders are to shoot anyone who tries to escape. You hear me?"
"You'd shoot them? Women and children?"
The young policeman looked miserable.
"Go!"
Isabel knew she should stay. That was the smart thing to do. But she could walk to the Veldive almost as quickly as these buses could drive there. It was only a few blocks away. Maybe then she would know what was happening. For the first time in months, the barricades on the side streets of Paris were unmanned. She ducked around one and ran down the street, toward the river, past closed-up shops and empty cafes. Only a few blocks away, she came to a breathless stop across the street from the stadium. An endless stream of buses jammed with people drew up alongside the huge building and disgorged passengers. Then the doors wheezed shut and the buses drove off again. Others drove up to take their place. she saw a sea of yellow stars. There were thousands of men, women, and children looking confused and despairing, being herded into the stadium. Most were wearing layers of clothing, too much for the July heat. Police patrolled the perimeter like American cowboys herding cattle, blowing whistles, shouting orders, forcing the Jewish people forward, into the stadium or onto other buses. Families. She saw a policeman shove a woman with his baton so hard she stumbled to her knees. She staggered upright, reaching blindly to the little boy beside her, protecting him with her body as she limped toward the stadium entrance. She saw a young French policeman and fought through the crowd to get to him.
"What's happening?" she asked. "That's not your concern, mademoiselle. Go."
Isabel looked back at the large cycling stadium. All she saw were people, bodies crammed together, families trying to hold on to each other in the melee. The police shouted at them, shoved them forward toward the stadium, yanked children and mothers to their feet when they fell. She could hear children crying. A pregnant woman was on her knees, rocking back and forth, clutching her distended belly.
"But there are too many of them in there," Isabel said.
"They'll be deported soon."
"Where?"
He shrugged.
"I know nothing about it."
"You must know something."
"Work camps," he mumbled. "In Germany, that's all I know."
"But they're women and children."
He shrugged again. Isabel couldn't comprehend it. How could the French gendarmes be doing this to Parisians, to women and children?
"Children can hardly work, monsieur. You must have thousands of children in there, and pregnant women. How?"
"Do I look like the mastermind of this? I just do what I'm told. They tell me to arrest the foreign-born Jews in Paris, so I do it. They want the crowd separated, single men to Drancy, families to the Veldive. Voila, it's done. Point rifles at them and be prepared to shoot. The government wants all of France's foreign Jews sent east to work camps, and we're starting here."
All of France? Isabel felt the air rush out of her lungs. Operation Spring Wind.
"You mean this isn't just happening in Paris?"
"No, this is just the start."
Vianne had stood in queues all day, in the oppressive summer heat, and for what? A half a pound of dry cheese and a loaf of terrible bread?
"Can we have some strawberry jam today, Maman? It hides the taste of the bread."
As they left the shop, Vianne kept Sophie close to her, tucked against her hip as if she were a much younger child.
"Maybe just a little. But we can't go overboard. Remember how terrible the winter was? Another will be coming."
Vianne saw a group of soldiers coming their way, rifles glinting in the sunshine. They marched past, and tanks followed them, grumbling over the cobblestone street.
"There is a lot going on out here today," Sophie said.
Vianne had been thinking the same thing. The road was full of French police. Gendarmes were coming into town in droves. It was a relief to step into Rachel's quiet, well-tended yard. She looked forward to her visits with Rachel so much. It was really the only time she felt like herself anymore. At Vianne's knock, Rachel peered out suspiciously, saw who was at the door, and smiled, opening the door wide, letting sunshine stream into the bare house.
"Vianne, Sophie, come in, come in!"
"Sophie!"
Sarah yelled. The two girls hugged each other as if they'd been apart for weeks instead of days. It had taken a toll on both of them to be separated while Sophie was sick. Sarah took Sophie by the hand and led her out into the front yard, where they sat beneath an apple tree. Rachel left the door open so that they could hear them. Vianne uncoiled the floral scarf from around her head and stuffed it into the pocket of her skirt.
"I brought you something."
"No, Vianne, we have talked about this," Rachel said.
She was wearing a pair of overalls that she'd made from an old shower curtain, her summer cardigan, once white and now grayed from too many washings and too much wear, hung from the chair back. From here, Vian could see two points of the yellow star sewn onto the sweater. Vian went to the counter in the kitchen and opened the silverware drawer. There was almost nothing left in it. In the 2 years of the occupation, they had all lost count of the times the Germans had gone door to door, requisitioning what they needed. How often had Germans broken into the homes at night, taking whatever they wanted? All of it ended up on trains headed east. Now, most of the drawers and closets and trunks in town were empty. All Rachel had left were a few forks and spoons and a single bread knife. Vian took the knife over to the table. Withdrawing the bread and cheese from her basket, she carefully cut both in half and returned her portion to the basket. When she looked up again, Rachel had tears in her eyes.
"I want to tell you not to give us that. You need it."
"You need it too."
"I should just rip the damn star off. Then at least I would be allowed to queue up for food when there was still some to be had."
There were constantly new restrictions in place for Jewish people. They could no longer own bicycles and were banned from all public places except between 3 and 4 p.m., when they were allowed to shop. By then, there was nothing left. Before Vian could answer, she heard a motorcycle out on the road. She recognized the sound of it and went to stand in the open doorway. Rachel squeezed in beside her.
"What is he doing here?"
"I'll see," Vian said.
"I'm coming with you."
Vian walked through the orchard, past a hummingbird hovering at the roses, to the gate. Opening it, she stepped through, onto the roadside, let Rachel in behind her. Behind them, the gate made a little click, like the snapping of a bone.
"Mesdames,"
Beck said, doffing his military cap, wedging it under his armpit.
"I am sorry to disturb your lady's time, but I have come to tell you something, Madame Moriac."
He put the slightest emphasis on you. It made it sound as if they shared secrets.
"Oh? And what is it, Herr Captain?" Vian asked.
He glanced left to right and then leaned slightly toward Vian.
"Madame de Champlain should not be at home tomorrow morning," he said quietly.
Vian thought perhaps he'd translated his intention poorly.
"Pardon?"
"Madame de Champlain should not be at home tomorrow," he repeated.
"My husband and I own this house," Rachel said. "Why should I leave?"
"It will not matter, this ownership of the house. Not tomorrow."
"My children?"
Rachel started. Beck finally looked at Rachel.
"Your children are of no concern to us. They were born in France. They are not on the list."
List. A word that was feared now. Vian said quietly,
"What are you telling us?"
"I am telling you that if she is here tomorrow, she will not be here the day after."
"But
if she were my friend, I would find a way to hide her for a day."
"Only for a day?"
Vian asked, studying him closely.
"That is all I came to say, madame, and I should not have done it. I would be punished if it got out. Please, if you are questioned about this later, do not mention my visit."
He clicked his heels together, pivoted, and walked away. Rachel looked at Vian. They had heard rumors of roundups in Paris, women and children being deported, but no one believed it. How could they? The claims were crazy, impossible. Tens of thousands of people taken from their homes in the middle of the night by the French police. And all at once, it couldn't be true.
"Do you trust him?"
Vian considered this question. She surprised herself by saying, "Yes."
"So what do I do?"
"Take the children to the free zone, tonight."
Vian couldn't believe she was thinking it, let alone saying it.
"Last week, Madame Durand tried to cross the frontier, and she was shot and her children deported."
Vian would say the same thing in Rachel's place. It was one thing for a woman to run by herself. It was another thing to risk your children's lives. But what if they were risking their lives by staying here?
You're right. It's too dangerous. But I think you should do as Beck advises. Hide. It is only for a day. Then perhaps we'll know more.
Where?
Isabel prepared for this, and I thought she was a fool. She sighed. There's a cellar in the barn.
You know that if you are caught hiding me...
Oui, Vian said sharply. She didn't want to hear it said aloud. Punishable by death. I know. Vian slipped a sleeping draught into Sophie's lemonade and put the child to bed early. Not the sort of thing that made one feel like a good mother, but neither was it all right to take Sophie with them tonight or let her awaken alone. Bad choices. That was all there were anymore. While waiting for her daughter to fall asleep, Vian paced. She heard every clatter of wind against the shutters, every creaky settling of the timbers of the old house. At just past 6 o'clock, she dressed in her old gardening overalls and went downstairs. She found Beck sitting on her divan, an oil lamp lit beside him. He was holding a small framed portrait of his family, his wife, Hilda, Vian knew, and his children, Gisela and Wilhelm. At her arrival, he looked up but didn't stand. Vian didn't know quite what to do. She wanted him to be invisible right now, tucked behind the closed door of his room, someone she could completely discount. And yet he had risked his career to help Rachel. How could she ignore that?
Bad things are happening, madame. Impossible things. I trained to be a soldier, to fight for my country and make my family proud. It was an honorable choice. What will be thought of us upon our return? What will be thought of me?
She sat down beside him.
I worry about what Antoine will think of me, too. I should not have given you that list of names. I should have been more frugal with my money. I should have worked harder to keep my job. Perhaps I should have listened to Isabel more.
You should not blame yourself. I'm sure your husband would agree. We men are perhaps too quick to reach for our guns.
He turned slightly, his gaze taking in her attire. She was dressed in her overalls and a black sweater. A black scarf covered her hair. She looked like a housewife version of a spy.
It is dangerous for her to run, he said.
And to stay, apparently.
And there it is, he said. A terrible dilemma.
Which is more dangerous, I wonder? Vian asked.
She expected no answer, and was surprised when he said,
Staying, I think.
Vian nodded.
You should not go, he said.
I can't let her go alone.
Beck considered that. Finally, he nodded.
You know the land of Monsieur Fret, where the cows are raised?
Oui, but...
There is a cattle trail behind the barn. It leads to the least manned of the checkpoints. It is a long walk. But one should make the checkpoint before curfew. If someone were wondering about that. Not that I know anyone who is.
My father, Julien Rossignol, lives in Paris at 57 Avenue de la Bourdonnais. If I didn't come home one day,
I would see that your daughter made it to Paris.
He rose, taking the picture with him.
I am to bed, madame.
She stood beside him.
I am afraid to trust you.
I should be more afraid not to.
They were closer now, ringed together by the meager light.
Are you a good man, Herr Captain?
I used to think so, madame.
Thank you, she said.
Do not thank me yet, madame.
He left her alone with the light and returned to his room, closing the door firmly behind him. Vian sat back down, waiting. At 7:30, she retrieved the heavy black shawl that hung from a hook by the kitchen door.
Be brave, she thought. Just this once.
She covered her head and shoulders with the shawl and went outside. Rachel and her children were waiting for her behind the barn. A wheelbarrow was beside them. In it, Ari lay wrapped in blankets, asleep. Tucked around him were a few possessions Rachel had chosen to take with her.
"You have false papers?" Vian asked.
Rachel nodded.
"I don't know how good they are, and they cost me my wedding ring."
She looked at Vian. They communicated everything without speaking aloud.
"Are you sure you want to come with us?"
"I'm sure."
"Why do we have to leave?"
Sarah said, looking frightened. Rachel put a hand on Sarah's head and gazed down at her.
"I need you to be strong for me, Sarah. Remember our talk?"
Sarah nodded slowly.
"For Ari and Papa."
They crossed the dirt road and pushed their way through the field of hay toward the copse of trees in the distance. Once in the spindly forest, Vian felt safer, protected somewhat. By the time they arrived at the Fret property, night had fallen. They found the cattle trail that led into a deeper wood, where thick, ropey roots veined the dry ground, causing Rachel to have to push the wheelbarrow hard to keep it moving. Time and again, it thumped over some root and clattered back down. Ari whimpered in his sleep and greedily sucked his thumb. Vian could feel the sweat running down her back.
"I have been in need of exercise," Rachel said, breathing heavily.
"And I love a good walk through the woods," Vian answered.
"What about you, Mademoiselle Sarah? What do you find lovely about our adventure?"
"I'm not wearing that stupid star," Sarah said. "How come Sophie isn't with us? She loves the woods. Remember the scavenger hunts we used to have? She found everything first."
Through a break in the trees up ahead, Vian saw a flashing light, and then the black and white markings of the border crossing. The gate was illuminated by lights so bright only the enemy would dare use them, or be able to afford to. A German guard stood by, his rifle glinting silver in the unnatural light. There was a small line of people waiting to pass through. Approval would only be granted if the paperwork was in order. If Rachel's false papers didn't work, she and the children would be arrested. It was real suddenly. Vian came to a stop. She would have to watch it all from here.
"I'll write if I can," Rachel said.
Vian's throat tightened. Even if the best happened, she might not hear from her friend for years. Or ever. In this new world, there was no certain way to keep in touch with those you love.
"Don't give me that look," Rachel said. "We will be together again in no time, drinking champagne and dancing to that jazz music you love."
Vian wiped the tears from her eyes.
"You know I won't be seen with you in public when you start dancing."
Sarah tugged at her sleeve.
"To tell Sophie I said goodbye."
Vian knelt down and hugged Sarah. She could have held on forever. Instead, she let go. She started to reach for Rachel, but her friend backed away.
"If I hug you, I'll cry, and I can't cry."
Vian's arms dropped heavily to her side. Rachel reached down for the wheelbarrow. She and her children left the protection of the trees and joined the queue of people at the checkpoint. A man on a bicycle pedaled through and kept going, and then an old woman pushing a flower cart was waved on. Rachel was almost to the front of the queue when a whistle shrieked and someone yelled in German. The guard turned his machine gun on the crowd and opened fire. Tiny red bursts peppered the dark.
"Rat-a-tat-tat!"
A woman screamed as the man beside her crumpled to the ground. The queue instantly dispersed. People ran in all directions. It happened so fast, Vian couldn't react. She saw Rachel and Sarah running toward her, back to the trees, Sarah in front, Rachel in back with the wheelbarrow.
"Here!"
Vian cried out, her voice lost in the splatter of gunfire. Sarah dropped to her knees in the grass.
"Sarah!"
Rachel cried. Vian swooped forward and pulled Sarah into her arms. She carried her into the woods and laid her on the ground, unbuttoning her coat. The girl's chest was riddled with bullet holes. Blood bubbled up, spilled over, oozing. Vian wrenched off her shawl and pressed it to the wounds.
"How is she?
Rachel asked, coming to a breathless stop beside her.
Is that blood?
Rachel crumpled to the grass beside her daughter. In the wheelbarrow, Ari started to scream. Lights flashed at the checkpoint. Soldiers gathered together. Dogs started barking.
We have to go, Rachel, Vian said. Now!
She clambered to her feet in the blood-slick grass and took Ari out of the wheelbarrow, shoving him at Rachel, who seemed not to understand. Vian threw everything out of the wheelbarrow and, as carefully as she could, placed Sarah in the rusted metal, with Ari's blanket behind her head. Clutching the handles in her bloody hands, she lifted the back wheels and began pushing.
Come on, she said to Rachel. We can save her.
Rachel nodded numbly. Vian shoved the wheelbarrow forward, over the ropey roots and dirt. Her heart was pounding, and fear was a sour taste in her mouth, but she didn't stop or look back. She knew that Rachel was behind her. Ari was screaming, and if anyone else was following them, she didn't want to know. As they neared Le Jardin, Vian struggled to push the heavy wheelbarrow through the gully alongside the road and up the hill to the barn. When she finally stopped, the wheelbarrow thumped down to the ground and Sarah moaned in pain. Rachel put Ari down. Then she lifted Sarah out of the wheelbarrow and gently placed her on the grass. Ari wailed and held his arms out to be held. Rachel knelt beside Sarah and saw the terrible devastation of Sarah's chest. She looked up at Vian, gave her a look of such pain and loss that Vian couldn't breathe. Then Rachel looked down again and placed a hand on her daughter's pale cheek. Sarah lifted her head.
Did we make it across the frontier?
Blood bubbled up from her colorless lips, slid down her chin.
We did, Rachel said. We did. We're all safe now. I was brave, Sarah said. Wasn't I? We,
Rachel said brokenly.
So brave. I'm cold, Sarah murmured.
She shivered. Sarah drew in a shuddering breath, exhaled slowly.
We are going to have some candy now, and a macaron. I love you, Sarah, and Papa loves you. You are our star.
Rachel's voice broke. She was crying now.
Our heart. You know that? Tell Sophie I...
Sarah's eyelids fluttered shut. She drew a last shuddering breath and went still. Her lips parted, but no breath slipped past them. Vian knelt down beside Sarah. She felt for a pulse and found none. The silence turned sour, thick. All Vian could think about was the sound of this child's laughter and how empty the world would be without it. She knew about death, about the grief that ripped you apart and left you broken forever. She couldn't imagine how Rachel was still breathing. If this was any other time, Vian would sit down beside Rachel, take her hand and let her cry, or hold her, or talk, or say nothing. Whatever Rachel needed, Vian would have moved heaven and earth to provide. But she couldn't do that now. It was another terrible blow in all of this. They couldn't even take time to grieve. Vian needed to be strong for Rachel.
We need to bury her, Vian said as gently as she could. She hates the dark.
My maman will be with her, Vian said, and yours. You and Ari need to go into the cellar. Hide. I'll take care of Sarah.
How?
Vian knew Rachel wasn't asking how to hide in the barn. She was asking how to live after a loss like this. How to pick up one child and let the other go. How to keep breathing after you whisper goodbye.
I can't leave her.
You have to. For Ari.
Vian got slowly to her feet, waiting. Rachel drew in a breath as clattery as broken glass and leaned forward to kiss Sarah's cheek.
I will always love you,
she whispered. At last, Rachel rose. She reached down for Ari, took him in her arms, held him so tightly he started to cry again. Vian reached for Rachel's hand and led her friend into the barn and to the cellar.
I will come get you as soon as it's safe.
Safe, Rachel said dully, staring back through the open barn door. Vian moved the car and opened the trap door.
There's a lantern down there, and food.
Holding Ari, Rachel climbed down the ladder and disappeared into the darkness. Vian shut the door on them and replaced the car, and then went to the lilac bush her mother had planted 30 years ago. It had spread tall and wide along the wall. Beneath it, almost lost amid the summer greenery, were 3 small white crosses. 2 for the miscarriages she'd suffered, and 1 for the son who'd lived less than a week. Rachel had stood here beside her as each of her boys was buried. Now Vian was here to bury her best friend's daughter. Her daughter's best friend. What kind of benevolent God would allow such a thing? Chapter 23. In the last few moments before dawn, Vian sat near the mound of fresh-turned earth. She wanted to pray, but her faith felt far away, the remnant of another woman's life. Slowly, she got to her feet. As the sky turned lavender and pink, ironically beautiful, she went to her backyard, where the chickens clucked and flapped their wings at her unexpected arrival. She stripped off her bloody clothes, left them in a heap on the ground, and washed up at the pump. Then she took a linen nightdress from the clothesline, put it on, and went inside. She was bone-tired and soul-weary, but there was no way she could rest. She lit an oil lamp and sat on the divan. She closed her eyes and tried to imagine Antoine beside her. What would she say to him now?
I don't know the right thing to do anymore. I want to protect Sophie and keep her safe. But what good is safety if she has to grow up in a world where people disappear without a trace because they pray to a different god? If I am arrested...
The door to the guest room opened. She heard Beck coming toward her. He was dressed in his uniform and freshly shaved, and she knew instinctively that he'd been waiting for her to return, worrying about her.
You're returned, he said.
She was sure he saw some spatter of blood or dirt somewhere on her, at her temple or on the back of her hand. There was an almost imperceptible pause. She knew he was waiting for her to look at him, to communicate what had happened, but she just sat there. If she opened her mouth, she might start screaming. Or if she looked at him, she might cry, might demand to know how it was that children could be shot in the dark for nothing.
Mama?
Sophie said, coming into the room.
You were not in bed when I woke up, she said. I got scared.
She clasped her hands in her lap.
I am sorry, Sophie.
Well, Beck said, I must leave. Goodbye.
As soon as the door closed behind him, Sophie came closer. She looked a little bleary-eyed, tired.
You're scaring me, Maman. Is something wrong?
Vian closed her eyes. She would have to give her daughter this terrible news, and then what? She would hold her daughter and stroke her head and let her cry, and she would have to be strong. She was so tired of being strong.
Come, Sophie, she said, rising. Let's sleep a little longer if we can.
That afternoon, in town, Vian expected to see soldiers gathering, rifles drawn, police wagons parked in the town square, dogs straining on leashes, black-clad SS officers, something to indicate trouble. But there was nothing out of the ordinary. She and Sophie remained in Carrevaux all day, standing in queues Vian knew were a waste of time, walking down one street after another. At first, Sophie talked incessantly. Vian barely noticed. How could she concentrate on normal conversation with Rachel and Ari hiding in her cellar and Sarah gone?
Can we leave now, Maman?
Sophie said at nearly 3 o'clock.
There's nothing more to be had. We're wasting our time.
Beck must have made a mistake. Or perhaps he was simply being overly cautious. Certainly, they would not round up and arrest Jewish people at this hour. Everyone knew that arrests were never made during mealtimes. The Nazis were much too punctual and organized for that, and they loved their French food and wine.
Oui, Sophie, we can go home.
They headed out of town. Vianne remained on alert, but if anything, the road was less crowded than usual. The airfield was quiet.
Can Sarah come over?
Sophie asked as Vianne eased the broken gate open. Sarah. Vianne glanced down at Sophie.
You look sad, her daughter said.
I am sad, Vianne said quietly.
Are you thinking of Papa?
Vianne drew in a deep breath and released it. Then she said gently,
Come with me,
and led Sophie to a spot beneath the apple tree where they sat together.
You are scaring me, Maman.
Vianne knew she was handling it badly already, but she had no idea how to do this. Sophie was too old for lies and too young for the truth. Vianne couldn't tell her that Sarah had been shot trying to cross the border. Her daughter might say the wrong thing to the wrong person.
Maman?
Vianne cupped Sophie's thin face in her hands.
Sarah died last night,
she said gently.
Died? She wasn't sick.
Vianne steeled herself.
It happens that way sometimes. God takes you unexpectedly. She's gone to heaven, to be with her grand-mère and yours.
Sophie pulled away, got to her feet, backed away.
Do you think I'm stupid?
What do you mean?
She's Jewish.
Vianne hated what she saw in her daughter's eyes right now. There was nothing young in her gaze. No innocence, no naivete, no hope. Not even grief. Just anger. A better mother would shape that anger into loss and then, at last, into the kind of memory of love one can sustain. But Vianne was too empty to be a good mother right now. She could think of no words that weren't a lie or useless. She ripped away the lacy trim at the end of her sleeve.
You see that bit of red yarn in the tree branch over our heads?
Sophie looked up. The yarn had lost a bit of color, faded, but still it showed up against the brown branches and green leaves and unripened apples. She nodded.
I put that there to remember your papa. Why don't you tie one for Sarah? And we'll think of her every time we are outside. But papa is not dead, Sophie said. Are you lying to...
No, no.
We remember the missing as much as the lost, don't we?
Sophie took the thready coil of lace in her hand, looking a little unsteady on her feet. She tied the strand onto the same branch. Vianne ached for Sophie to come back, turn to her, reach out for a hug. But her daughter just stood there, staring at the scrap of lace, her eyes bright with tears.
It won't always be like this,
was all Vianne could think of to say.
I don't believe you.
Sophie looked at her at last.
I'm taking a nap.
Vianne could only nod. Ordinarily, she would have been undone by this tension with her daughter, overwhelmed by a sense of having failed. Now she just sighed and got to her feet. She wiped the grass from her skirt and headed up to the barn. Inside, she rolled the Renault forward and opened the cellar door.
Rach, it's me. Thank God,
came a whispery voice from the darkness. Rachel climbed up the creaking ladder and emerged into the dusty light, holding Ari.
What happened?
Rachel asked tiredly.
Nothing.
Nothing?
I went to town. Everything seems normal. Maybe Beck was being overly cautious, but I think you should spend one more night down there.
Rachel's face was drawn, tired-looking.
I'll need diapers and a quick bath. Ari and I both smell.
The toddler started to cry. She pushed the damp curls away from her sweat-dampened forehead and murmured to him in a soft, lilting voice. They left the barn and headed for Rachel's house next door. They were nearly to the front door when a French police car pulled up out front. Paul got out of the car and strode into the yard, carrying his rifle.
"Are you Rachel de Champlain?" he asked.
Rachel frowned.
"You know I am."
"You are being deported. Come with me."
Rachel tightened her hold on Ari.
"Don't take my son."
"He is not on the list," Paul said.
Vian grabbed the man's sleeve.
"You can't do this, Paul. She is French."
"She's a Jew."
He pointed his rifle at Rachel.
"Move."
Rachel started to say something, but Paul silenced her. He grabbed her by the arm, yanked her out to the road, and forced her into the back seat of his automobile. Vian meant to stay where she was. Safe, intended to. But the next thing she knew, she was running alongside the automobile, banging on the bonnet, begging to be let inside. Paul slammed on the brakes, let her climb into the back seat, and then he stomped on the gas.
"Go,"
Rachel said as they passed Le Jardin.
"This is no place for you."
"This is no place for anyone," Vian said.
Even a week ago, she might have let Rachel go alone. She might have turned away, with regret, probably, and guilt, certainly, but she would have thought that protecting Sophie was more important than anything else. Last night had changed her. She still felt fragile and frightened, maybe more so, but she was angry now, too. In town, there were barricades on a dozen streets. Police wagons were everywhere, disgorging people with yellow stars on their chests, herding them toward the train station where cattle cars waited. There were hundreds of people. They must have come from all the communes in the area. Paul parked and opened the car doors. Vian and Rachel and Ari stepped into the crowd of Jewish women and children and old men making their way to the platform. A train waited, puffing black smoke into the already hot air. Two German soldiers were standing on the platform. One of them was Beck. He was holding a whip.
A whip?
But it was French police who were in charge of the roundup. They were forcing people into lines and shoving them into the cattle cars. Men went into one cattle car, women and children in the other. Up ahead, a woman holding a baby tried to run. A gendarme shot her in the back. She pitched to the ground, dead. The baby rolled to the boots of the gendarme holding a smoking gun. Rachel stopped, turned to Vian.
"Take my son," she whispered.
The crowd jostled them.
"Take him! Save him!" Rachel pleaded.
Vian didn't hesitate. She knew now that no one could be neutral, not anymore. And as afraid as she was of risking Sophie's life, she was suddenly more afraid of letting her daughter grow up in a world where good people did nothing to stop evil, where a good woman could turn her back on a friend in need. She reached for the toddler, took him in her arms.
"You!"
A gendarme stabbed Rachel in the shoulder with the butt of his rifle, so hard she stumbled.
"Move!"
She looked at Vian, and the universe of their friendship was in her eyes. The secrets they'd shared, the promises they'd made and kept, the dreams for their children that bound them as neatly as sisters.
"Get out of here!"
Rachel cried hoarsely.
"Go!"
Vian backed away. Before she knew it, she had turned and begun shoving her way through the crowd, away from the platform and the soldiers and the dogs, away from the smell of fear and the crack of whips and the sound of women wailing and babies crying. She didn't allow herself to slow until she reached the end of the platform. There, holding Ari closely, she turned around. Rachel stood in the black, yawning entrance of the cattle car, her face and hands still smeared with her daughter's blood. She scanned the crowd, saw Vian, and raised her bloody hand in the air. And then she was gone, shoved back by the women stumbling in around her. The door to the cattle car clanged shut. Vian collapsed onto the divan. Ari was crying uncontrollably, and his diaper was wet and he smelled of urine. She should get up, take care of him, do something. But she couldn't move. She felt weighed down by loss, suffocated by it. Sophie came into the living room.
"Why do you have Ari?"
she said in a quiet, frightened voice.
"Where's Madame de Champlain?"
"She is gone," Vian said. She hadn't the strength to fabricate a lie, and what was the good of one anyway? There was no way to protect her daughter from all of the evil around them. No way. Sophie would grow up knowing too much, knowing fear and loss and probably hatred.
"Rachel was born in Romania," Vian said tightly.
"That, along with being Jewish, was her crime. The Vichy government doesn't care that she has lived in France for 25 years and married a Frenchman, and that he fought for France. So they deported her."
"Where will they take her?"
"I don't know."
"Will she come back after the war?"
"Yes. No. I hope so." What answer would a good mother give?
"I hope so."
"And Ari?"
Sophie asked. "He will stay with us. He wasn't on the list. I guess our government believes children can raise themselves."
"But Maman, what do we..."
"Do? What do we do?"
"I have no idea." She sighed. "For now, you watch the baby. I'll go next door and get his crib and clothes." Vian was almost to the door when Sophie said,
"What about Captain Beck?"
Vian stopped dead. She remembered seeing him on the platform with a whip in his hand, a whip he cracked to herd women and children onto a cattle car.
"Oui," she said. "What about Captain Beck?"
Vian washed her blood-soaked clothes and hung them to dry in the backyard, trying not to notice how red the soapy water was when she splashed it across the grass. She made Sophie and Ari supper. What had she made? She couldn't remember. And put them to bed. But once the house was quiet and dark, she couldn't suppress her emotions. She was angry, howlingly so, and devastated. She couldn't stand how dark and ugly her thoughts were, how bottomless her anger and grief. She ripped the pretty lace from her collar and stumbled outside, remembering when Rachel had given her this blouse 3 years ago.
"It's what everyone's wearing in Paris."
The apple trees spread their arms above her. It took her 2 tries to tie the scrap of fabric to the knobby wooden branch between Antoine's and Sarah's, and when she'd done it, she stepped back. Sarah. Rachel. Antoine. The scraps of color blurred. That was when she realized she was crying.
"Please, God,"
she began to pray, looking up at the bits of fabric and lace and yarn tied around the knobby branch, interspersed with unripe apples. What good were prayers now, when her loved ones were gone? She heard a motorcycle come up the road and park outside Le Jardin. Moments later,
"Madame?"
She spun to face him.
"Where's your whip, Herr Captain?" "You were there?"
"How does it feel to whip a French woman?"
"You can't think I would do that, Madame. It sickens me."
"And yet there you were."
"As were you. This war has put us all where we do not want to be."
"Less so for you Germans."
"I tried to help her,"
he said. At that, Vian felt the rage go out of her. Her grief returned. He had tried to save Rachel. If only they had listened to him and kept her hidden longer. She swayed. Beck reached out and steadied her.
"You said to hide her in the morning. She was in that terrible cellar all day. By afternoon, I thought,
Everything seemed normal.
Von Richter adjusted the timetable. There was a problem with the trains.
The trains. Rachel waving goodbye. Vianne looked up at him.
Where are they taking her?
It was the first substantive question she'd ever asked him.
To a work camp in Germany.
I hid her all day,
Vianne said again, as if it mattered now.
The Wehrmacht aren't in control anymore. It's the Gestapo and the SS. They're more brutes than soldiers.
Why were you there?
I was following orders. There are her children.
Your Germans shot Sarah in the back at the frontier checkpoint.
Mein Gott, he muttered.
I have her son. Why wasn't Ari on the list?
He was born in France and is under 14. They are not deporting French Jews.
He looked at her.
Yet.
Vianne caught her breath.
Will they come for Ari?
I believe that soon they will deport all Jews, regardless of age or place of birth. And when they do, it will become dangerous to have any Jew in your home.
Children. Deported. Alone.
The horror of it was unbelievable, even after what she'd already seen.
I promised Rachel I'd keep him safe. Will you turn me in?
She asked.
I am not a monster, Vianne.
It was the first time he'd ever used her Christian name. He moved closer.
I fought to protect you, he said.
It was the worst thing he could have said. She had felt lonely for years, but now she truly was alone. He touched her upper arm, almost a caress, and she felt it in every part of her body, like an electrical charge. Unable to help herself, she looked at him. He was close to her, just a kiss away. All she had to do was give him the slightest encouragement, a breath, a nod, a touch, and he would close the gap between them. For a moment, she forgot who she was and what had happened today. She longed to be soothed, to forget. She leaned the smallest bit forward, enough to smell his breath, feel it on her lips. And then she remembered, all at once, in a whoosh of anger, and she pushed him away so he stumbled. She scrubbed her lips as if they'd touched his.
We can't, she said.
Of course not.
But when he looked at her, and she looked at him, they both knew that there was something worse than kissing the wrong person. It was wanting to.
Chapter 24. Summer ended. Hot golden days gave way to washed out skies and falling rain. Isabel was so focused on the escape route that she hardly noticed the change in weather. On a chilly October afternoon, she stepped out of the train carriage in a crowd of passengers, holding a bouquet of autumn flowers. As she walked up the boulevard, German motor cars clogged the street, honking loudly. Soldiers strode confidently among the cowed, drab Parisians. Swastika flags flapped in the wintry wind. She hurried down the metro steps. The tunnel to the metro was crowded with people and papered in Nazi propaganda that demonized the Brits and Jews and made the Führer the answer to every question. Suddenly, the air raid sirens howled. The electricity snapped off, plunging everyone into darkness. She heard people muttering and babies crying and old men coughing. From far away, she could hear the thump and grumble of explosions. It was probably Boulogne-Billancourt again, and why not? Renault was making lorries for the Germans. When the all-clear finally sounded, no one moved until moments later, when the electricity and lights came back on. Isabel was almost to the train when a whistle blared. She froze. Nazi soldiers, accompanied by French collaborators, moved through the tunnel, talking to one another, pointing at people, pulling them out to the perimeter, forcing them to their knees. A rifle appeared in front of her.
"Papers," the German said.
Isabel clutched the flowers in one hand and fumbled nervously with her purse with the other. She had a message for a nuke wrapped within the bouquet. It was not unexpected, of course, this search. Since the Allied successes in North Africa had begun, the Germans stopped people constantly, demanding papers. In the streets, the shops, the train stations, the churches, there was no safety anywhere. She handed over her false carte d'identité.
"I am meeting a friend of my mother's for lunch."
The Frenchman sidled up to the German and perused the papers. He shook his head, and the German handed Isabel her papers and said,
"Go."
Isabel smiled quickly, nodded a thank you, and hurried for the train, slipping into an open carriage just as the door slid shut. By the time she exited in the 16th arrondissement, her calm had returned. A wet fog clung to the streets, obscuring the buildings and the barges moving slowly on the Seine. Sounds were amplified by the haze, turned strange. Somewhere, a ball was bouncing, probably boys playing in the street. One of the barges honked its horn and the noise lingered. At the avenue, she turned the corner and went to a bistro, one of the few with its lights on. A nasty wind ruffled the awning. She passed the empty tables and went to the outside counter, where she ordered a café au lait, without coffee or milk, of course.
"Juliette, is that you?"
Isabel saw Anouk and smiled.
"Gabrielle, how lovely to see you."
Isabel handed Anouk the flowers. Anouk ordered a coffee. While they stood there, sipping coffee in the icy weather, Anouk said,
"I spoke with my Uncle Henri yesterday. He misses you."
"Is he unwell?"
No, quite the opposite. He is planning a party for next Tuesday night. He asked me to extend an invitation.
Shall I take him a gift for you?"
"No, but a letter would be nice. Here, I have it ready for you."
Isabel took the letter and slipped it into the lining of her purse. Anouk looked at her. Smoky shadows circled her eyes. New lines had begun to crease her cheeks and brows. This life in the shadows had begun to take a toll on her.
"Are you all right, my friend?" Isabel asked.
Anouk's smile was tired but true.
"Oui,"
she paused.
"I saw Gaetan last night. He will be at the meeting in Carrivaux."
"Why tell me?"
"Isabel, you are the most transparent person I have ever met. Every thought and feeling you have reveals itself in your eyes. Are you unaware how often you have mentioned him to me?"
"Really? I thought I had hidden it."
"It's nice, actually. It reminds me of what we are fighting for. Simple things. A girl and a boy and their future."
She kissed Isabel's cheeks. Then she whispered,
"He mentions you as well."
Luckily for Isabel, it was raining in Carrivaux on this late October day. No one paid attention to people in weather like this, not even the Germans. She flipped her hood up and held her coat shut at her throat. Even so, rain pelted her face and slid in cold streaks down her neck as she hauled her bicycle off the train and walked it across the platform. On the outskirts of town, she climbed aboard. Choosing a lesser-used alley, she pedaled into Carrivaux, bypassing the square. On a rainy autumn day like this, there were few people out and about, only women and children standing in food queues, their coats and hats dripping rainwater. The Germans were mostly inside. By the time she reached the Hotel Bellevue, she was exhausted. She dismounted, locked her bicycle to a street lamp, and went inside. A bell jangled overhead, announcing her arrival to the German soldiers who were seated in the lobby, drinking their afternoon coffees.
"Mademoiselle,"
one of the officers said, reaching for a flaky golden pain au chocolat.
"You are soaking wet. These French do not know enough to get out of the rain."
They laughed at that. She kept smiling and walked past them. At the hotel's front desk, she rang the bell. Henri came out of the back room, holding a tray of coffees. He saw her and nodded.
"One moment, madame,"
Henri said, gliding past her, carrying the tray to a table where two SS agents sat like spiders in their black uniforms. When Henri returned to the front desk, he said,
"Madame Gervaise, welcome back. It is good to see you again. Your room is ready, of course. If you'll follow me."
She nodded and followed Henri down the narrow hallway and up the stairs to the second floor. There, he pressed a skeleton key into a lock, gave it a twist, and opened the door to reveal a small bedroom with a single bed, a nightstand, and a lamp. He led her inside, kicked the door shut with his foot, and took her in his arms.
"Isabelle," he said, pulling her close. "It's good to see you."
He released her and stepped back.
"With Romainville, I worried."
Isabelle lowered her wet hood.
"Oui."
In the past 2 months, the Nazis had cracked down on what they called saboteurs and resistors. They had finally begun to see the role women were playing in this war and had imprisoned over 200 French women in Romainville. She unbuttoned her coat and draped it over the end of the bed. Reaching into the lining, she pulled out an envelope and handed it to Henri.
"Here you go,"
she said, giving him money that had come from MI9. His hotel was one of the key safe houses their group maintained. Isabelle loved that they housed Brits and Yanks and resistors right under the Nazis' noses. Tonight she would be a guest in this smallest of rooms. She pulled out a chair from behind a scarred writing desk and sat down.
"The meeting is set for tonight?"
11 p.m. in the abandoned barn on the Angler farm.
"What's it about?"
"I'm not in the know."
He sat down on the end of the bed. She could tell by the look on his face that he was going to get serious, and she groaned.
"I hear the Nazis are desperate to find the Nightingale. Word is that they're trying to infiltrate the escape route."
"I know this, Henri."
She lifted one eyebrow.
"I hope you are not going to tell me that it's dangerous."
"You are going too often, Isabelle. How many trips have you made?"
24.
Henri shook his head.
"No wonder they are desperate to find you. We heard word of another escape route, running through Marseille and Perpignan, that is having success too. There is going to be trouble, Isabelle."
She was surprised by how much his concern moved her, and how nice it was to hear her own name. It felt good to be Isabelle Rossignol again, even if only for a few moments, and to sit with someone who knew her. So much of her life was spent hiding and on the run, in safe houses with strangers. Still, she saw no reason to talk about this. The escape route was invaluable and worth the risk they were taking.
"You are keeping an eye on my sister, oui?"
"Oui."
"The Nazi still billets there?"
Henri's gaze slid away from hers.
"What is it?"
"Vianne was fired from her teaching post some time ago."
"Why? Her students love her. She's an excellent teacher."
"The rumor is that she questioned a Gestapo officer."
"That doesn't sound like Vianne. So she has no income. What is she living on?"
Henri looked uncomfortable.
"There is gossip."
"Gossip?"
"About her and the Nazi."
All summer long, Vianne hid Rachel's son in Le Jardin. She made sure never to venture out with him, not even to garden. Without papers, she couldn't pretend that he was anyone other than Ariel de Champlain. She had to let Sophie stay at home with the child, and so each journey to town was a nerve-wracking event that couldn't be over soon enough. She told everyone she could think of, shopkeepers, nuns, villagers, that Rachel had been deported with both her children. It was all she could think of to do. Today, after a long, slogging day standing in line only to be told there was nothing left, Vianne left town feeling defeated. There were rumors of more deportations, more roundups happening all over France. Thousands of French Jews were being held at internment camps. At home, she hung her wet cloak on an exterior hook by the front door. She had no real hope that it would dry out before tomorrow, but at least it wouldn't drip all over her floor. She stepped out of her muddy rubber boots by the door and went into the house. As usual, Sophie was standing by the door, waiting for her.
"I'm fine," Vianne said.
Sophie nodded solemnly.
"So are we.
Will you give Ari a bath while I make supper?"
Sophie scooped Ari into her arms and left the room. Vianne uncoiled the scarf from her hair and hung it up. Then she set her basket in the sink to dry out and went down to the pantry, where she chose a sausage and some undersized, softening potatoes and onions. Back in the kitchen, she lit the stove and preheated her black cast-iron skillet. Adding a drop of the precious oil, she browned the sausage. Vianne stared down at the meat, breaking it up with her wooden spoon, watching it turn from pink to gray to a nice crusty brown. When it was crispy, she added cubed potatoes and diced onions and garlic. The garlic popped and browned and released its scent into the air.
"That smells delicious."
"Herr Captain," she said quietly, "I didn't hear your motorcycle."
"Mademoiselle Sophie let me in."
She turned down the flame on the stove and covered the pan, then faced him. By tacit agreement, they both pretended that the night in the orchard had never happened. Neither had mentioned it, and yet it was in the air between them always. Things had changed that night, subtly. He ate supper with them most nights now, mostly food that he brought home, never large amounts, just a ham slice or a bag of flour or a few sausages. He spoke openly of his wife and children, and she talked about Antoine. All their words were designed to reinforce a wall that had already been breached. He repeatedly offered, most kindly, to mail Vianne's care packages to Antoine, which she filled with whatever small items she could spare. Old winter gloves that were too big, cigarettes Beck left behind, a precious jar of jam. Vianne made sure never to be alone with Beck. That was the biggest change. She didn't go out into the backyard at night or stay up after Sophie went to bed. She didn't trust herself to be alone with him.
"I have brought you a gift," he said.
He held out a set of papers, a birth certificate for a baby born June of 1939 to Etienne and Aimé Mauriac, a boy named Daniel Antoine Mauriac. Vianne looked at Beck. Had she told him that she and Antoine had wanted to name a son Daniel? She must have, although she didn't remember it.
"It is unsafe to house Jewish children now, or it will be very soon."
"You have taken such a risk for him. For us," she said.
"For you," he said quietly. "And they are false papers, madame. Remember that. To go along with the story that you adopted him from a relative."
"I will never tell them they came from you."
"It is not myself I worry about, madame. Ari must become Daniel immediately, completely. And you must be extremely careful. The Gestapo and the SS are brutes. The Allied victories in Africa are hitting us hard. And this final solution for the Jews, it is an evil impossible to comprehend. I..."
He paused, gazed down at her.
"I want to protect you."
"You have,"
she said, looking up at him. He started to move toward her, and she to him, even as she knew it was a mistake. Sophie came running into the kitchen.
"Ari is hungry, Maman. He keeps complaining."
Beck came to a stop. Reaching past her, brushing her arm with his hand, he picked up a fork on the counter. Taking it, he speared one perfect bite of sausage, a crispy brown cube of potato, a chunk of caramelized onion. As he ate it, he stared down at her. He was so close now that she could feel his breath on her cheek.
You are a most amazing cook, madame.
Merci, she said in a tight voice. He stepped back.
I regret I cannot stay for supper, madame. I must away.
Vian tore her gaze away from him and smiled at Sophie.
Set the table for three, she said.
Later, while supper simmered on the stove, Vian gathered the children together on their bed.
Sophie, Ari, come here. I need to speak with you.
What is it, maman?
Sophie asked, looking worried already.
They are deporting French-born Jews, she paused. Children, too.
Sophie drew in a sharp breath and looked at three-year-old Ari, who bounced happily on the bed. He was too young to learn a new identity. She could tell him his name was Daniel Mauriac from now until forever, and he wouldn't understand why. If he believed in his mother's return and waited for that, sooner or later he would make a mistake that would get him deported, maybe one that would get them all killed. She couldn't risk that. She would have to break his heart to protect them all.
Forgive me, Rachel.
She and Sophie exchanged a pained look. They both knew what had to be done. But how could one mother do this to another woman's child?
Ari, she said quietly, taking his face in her hands. Your maman is with the angels in heaven. She won't be coming back.
He stopped bouncing.
What?
She's gone forever, Vian said again,
feeling her own tears rise and fall. She would say it over and over until he believed it.
I am your maman now, and you will be called Daniel.
He frowned, chewing noisily on the inside of his mouth, splaying his fingers as if he were counting.
You said she was coming back.
Vian hated to say it.
She's not. She's gone. Like the sick baby rabbit we lost last month, remember?
They had buried it in the yard with great ceremony.
Gone like the bunny?
Tears filled his brown eyes, spilled over, his mouth trembled. Vian took him in her arms and held him and rubbed his back. But she couldn't soothe him enough, nor could she let him go. At last, she eased back enough to look at him.
Do you understand, Daniel? You'll be my brother,
Sophie said, her voice unsteady.
Truly.
Vian felt her heart break, but she knew there was no other way to keep Rachel's son safe. She prayed that he was young enough to forget that he was ever Ari, and the sadness of that prayer was overwhelming.
Say it, she said evenly. Tell me your name.
Daniel,
he said, obviously confused, trying to please. Vian made him say it a dozen times that night, while they ate their supper of sausage and potatoes, and later, when they washed the dishes and dressed for bed. She prayed that this ruse would be enough to save him, that his papers would pass inspection. Never again would she call him Ari, or even think of him as Ari. Tomorrow, she would cut his hair as short as possible. Then she would go to town and tell everyone, that gossip Hélène Ruel would be first, of the child she'd adopted from a dead cousin in Nice. God help them all.